In the spring of 1919, I was serving ashore at Osi Island with our coastal motorboats. These boats were fast motorboats designed by Sir John Thornycroft of a skimmer design. We carried one torpedo, and the bigger boats carried two, and our purpose was to operate in small groups called flotillas against enemy ships and torpedo them. In Russia, they lost all contacts with their secret agents, and the head of our secret service thought, perhaps, that these fast boats of ours might help him in getting his agents across into Petrograd, which lay on the River Neva. And I was chosen to handle this job, to take two of our fast boats and their crews across from Osi Island to the Gulf of Finland. Our boats were put aboard a Swedish coaster, ostensibly for Stockholm, but we offloaded the boats at a port called Hango in Finland. All done in the greatest of secrecy, and of course with the backing of the Foreign Office behind us, with money and influence. He wore civilian clothes. We were told, and actually did, forget everything about the Navy. We took our own money with us. I was given £1,000 for our expenses, the first time in my life I'd ever handled such a sum of money. And having offloaded the boats, I was faced with the problem of getting them across the coast of Finland as close as I could to Petrograd. Our intention at first was to take these couriers, as we called them, they were secret agents, from the coast of Finland, land them at night across the Gulf of Finland on the coast of Estonia, a matter of about, 50 miles or so, perhaps a little bit under, which was well within our capacity, but nevertheless, it was a very, very stiff problem, this, to get the boats across this long stretch of coastline, and our first problem was how to do that. All this was planned in the mind of a wonderful man. He was the head of our secret service. Everyone called him by one single letter of the alphabet, C, and he was known as C. He planned this whole show. Well, this problem still remained, and a solution luckily occurred by sheer luck. We knew that the British Navy had a small squadron of cruisers and destroyers operating in the Baltic, not necessarily the Gulf of Finland. They were concerned more with the liberation of the Baltic states than with the Gulf of Finland itself. Well, one afternoon, when we were pottering round the quay at Helsinki, I saw a destroyer come in, unload some bags of mail, take on board a few secret bags, obviously sent from our consulate at Helsingfors, and sail again into the blue. Obviously, she'd come from this squadron, which is commanded by an admiral called Walter Cullen. It then occurred to me that if I could get in touch with Admiral Cullen, he might help me out and perhaps lend me one of these destroyers to tow my boats close to the Gulf, to the actual Gulf of Finland, say 100 to 120 miles. I then went to the consulate, where we had one of our secret agents, and I had a letter written out. The secret agent took this to the minister, who was a most awfully nice man. He wasn't a professional diplomat. He was, in ordinary life, a businessman from Dundee in the timber trade. But he happened to speak fluent Finnish, fluent German, and Swedish, and he had a German wife. He was so very popular with the Finns and a great personal friend of General Mannerheim. His name was Bell, H.M. Bell. Well, to cut a long story short, the next thing I heard was a message from Bell to say the Admiral had received my letter, and I saw the Admiral the next day. No one could have been more helpful or kinder. And he said anything he could do to help would be done, and if I wanted a destroyer to tow my two boats when they were offloaded from the steamer at Tango, he would have one waiting for me at sea. And all that was necessary was to fix up a rendezvous, and the destroyer would tow at high speed these two little boats to the Gulf of Finland and slip them when we were close to the shore. There was one further point. I never met the Admiral before, but I judged that he was the type of man that I could trust him with my own conscience. So I said to him, I said, "Look here, sir, we may have some opposition sometimes." Well, I asked him, could let me have a couple of torpedoes? He said, "Yes, I could arrange it." Then he paused. He said, "But look here, you're civilians." He said, "I couldn't have that. Couldn't have civilians using torpedoes." I said, "No, but there was one thing C did allow us, although he insisted we operate and act entirely as civilians." He said, "If the worst comes to the worst, I'll allow you to put in the boat, provided you don't take them out of the boat, each of you, an overall, uniform cap, and a uniform coat, so that you could, if the worst came to the worst, say that you were operating as service people. Might save your lives." "Well," he said, "if it's like that, you can have the torpedoes, but not a word to anyone else." 2 days later, the Swedish cargo steamer called in at Tango, offloaded the two boats. The crews consisted of myself, and each boat carried a midshipman. I had Hampshire in my boat, and Sindel in command of the second boat, and Marshall. We each had a mechanic. I had Bealey, afterwards known as Faithful Bealey, wonderful man, wonderful mechanic. And Sindel had Piper. Both were first rate. All were young. We offloaded at Hango. We went to sea at once. The boats, in the meanwhile, had been painted a different colour, We went to the rendezvous. It was a small matter of 15 miles or so. And there, sure enough, was the destroyer waiting for us, HMS Voyager. This was around about 6-7 o'clock in the evening. And she took us all the way along the Finnish coast to the northern part of the Gulf of Finland, in a place called Bjorko. And there, the tow was slipped, and we went into the sound, where I could see, after a little while, the small Admiralty oiler anchored at the tail end of the sound. We made straight for her. And once alongside the oiler, it was obvious that they were expecting us. We made fast, and the master, tell me he'd got supplies for us, petrol and stores, food. Then he took me by the sleeve of my coat and he said, look here, young fella, I've got something you might be interested in. Come with me. And he took me to the after part of the small oiler, where there was two or three large tarpaulins and something under them. He said, these are new steel. He lifted the tarpaulins, and underneath there were two submarine torpedoes. Well, it didn't take us long to get those in. So we were ready, in a way, to go to our next secret destination. We needed badly a secret base, and luck was on my side. One of our secret agents, I had two specially attached to me, ST-31 and ST-30, suggested to me that there was a small, tiny harbour further in the Gulf of Finland, and very close, dangerously close, one should say, to the Russian frontier. Now, this tiny harbour was, in ordinary days of peace, the headquarters of the Tsarist Sailing Club, but now it was derelict. Well, the problem was to get the boats there. And I could only do this secretly and at night, but I was first of all make sure that it suited us. And I was assured that it would, and also that my secret agents had the means of getting stores there, of petrol, oil, and other things, besides a nice house where we could live. They called them dachas, because attached to the yacht club were several dozen of these delightful dachas, used again in pre-war days, in Tsarist days, by members of the yacht club. I decided to use this harbour and one of the dachas as our headquarters. So we left round about 10 o'clock at night, took both boats, not at high speed, keeping well out of sight of the coastline. We steered towards the Russian frontier. Having got to a point which we thought was about the right distance from the shore, we turned in to try and find this place. But to make sure, I had one of our secret agents on the end of the small breakwater by the yacht club, flashing a powerful electric torch with a secret signal. And sure enough, the agent was there and the signal was there. It was perfect, absolutely ideal for our purpose. Tiny, small harbour, a small breakwater, a club, too large for the purpose. It was plenty of room for all our stores and everything else. And in the middle was an old Swedish sailing boat at anchor, which we used as a mooring. And we unloaded what we'd taken from the oiler and had some sleep, badly needed, I may tell you. Our purpose was to get in touch with our main agent inside Russia. His number was ST-25, and that's all we knew about him. Now, to do this, I proposed as soon as we could to make our final journey from Teriyaki, which is the name of the secret place where we'd arrived, to the mouth of the river Neva, as the crow flies, in a direct line, was no more than about, I would say, 40 miles. A relatively short journey for boats of ours, which could do over 40 knots. But there was a lot in between the two. There was the, first of all, to the south, there was Kronstadt, this large, enormous fortress on Katlin Island. Between Kronstadt and the mainland on the north, there was a series of fortresses, about 10 or 12 of them, all small fortresses, and not more than 400 yards apart, each one of them. They were connected in turn by breakwaters. They were 3 to 4 feet below the water. And according to the secret chart, there were 3 of them. I managed, luckily, when we were in Helsingfors, with the help of our senior agent, a man called Sokolov, to get one of the secret Russian charts. And on these Russian charts was shown the exact position of these breakwaters. And this man assured me that they were very narrow boat passages in these, between these breakwaters, which were known to him and the smugglers who used them in the, for smuggling between Finland and Petrograd. Well, if I could be sure of it and get the boats through one of these passages, there was nothing between the fortresses and the River Neva on the other side. And once I could get to the River Neva, there I could land an agent who would contact ST-25 and within, say, a few days or a week, bring him back. I felt my luck was in. I've always been an optimist. I'm the 13th of a family of 13, and I'm sure my luck would hold. So I decided at once to make my first effort and land Sokolov in the River Neva. A big decision for me as a young lieutenant, aged not more than 27, but still it had to be done. I decided to leave at 10 o'clock at night, as our hours of darkness were very limited. Between 10 and 2 o'clock And when it comes to the middle of June, that's to say, 21st, 22nd of June, it's limited further. So whatever I did, I had to get and do it between the up to the 21st of June. I landed my first courier by going through the chain of forts using a track which I'd plotted from the Russian chart. My path took me between the two forts numbers 7 and 8, if my memory serves me right. And once through those forts, I cracked on full speed, which was 40 knots, and it was a matter of minutes before I was in the mouth of the River Neva. Once at the mouth of the River Neva, we unloaded a small skiff, they called it a pram, which I carried in the CMB, and into which I put the courier, and he rowed towards the reeds. In the meanwhile, I turned back, and I headed the boat back for Teriyaki, the same way as I'd come. Now, we were lucky in crossing the breakwaters, very lucky. Although I trusted to a certain extent the tracks given us by the smugglers, they call them contrabandists, and I had one on board. I paid him heavily. It so happens that after a series of southwesterly winds, the water in the Gulf piles up, sometimes as much as 3 feet. And it so happens that there had been a series of southwesterly winds, and the water was at least a foot, if not 2 foot, higher than it normally would have been. That meant to say that the breakwaters, the stone breakwaters guarding this chain of forts, were 4 to 5 feet below the surface of the water. Now, our boats were designed on the principle of the skimmer, and we drew, even at high speed, about 3 foot 6 light, when we were light. And for that reason, we could skim over the breakwaters, irrespective of where the secret channels were. And to that extent, luck was on our side, also on our side, in being able to steam over minefields, because the whole of the Gulf was littered, simply littered, with Russian minefields, their favorite weapon of war. Having got through, I then, instead of going direct to Teriyaki, I continued towards Tolbukhin Lighthouse. I wanted to make a reconnaissance for the benefit of the Admiral and see what the Russians from Kronstadt had out. What sort of patrol craft? Were there any destroyers? Cruisers? Perhaps. And I made a detour before reaching Teriyaki, which we did by daylight. So far, so good. We landed the courier, Sokolov, and I'm quite certain in my own mind that he would have little difficulty in contacting ST-25 in Petrograd. All we had now to do was to wait until my return, which I arranged for 4 days. Much happened in those 4 days. I must explain. The Gulf of Finland is so situated that on either end, the northern end, there's a master fortress called Fort Inonini, and on the southern end, another master fortress, even more powerful, called Krasnaya Gorka. The northern fortress was in the hands of the Finns, the southern fortress in the hands of the Bolsheviks. But it so happens that on the day I landed our courier and the River Neva, the Estonian white Englanders mutinied against their guards in the Red Fortress at Krasnaya Gorka and hoisted the white flag. The Bolshevik reply to this was, of course, to send out units from the Red Fleet in Kronstadt and bombard the Red Fort from the rear, because the guns of the Red Fort only could point to seaward. So the unfortunate Engelmandanders in the Krasnaya Gorka could do nothing about it except take what punishment was given to them. And this, alas, we watched from Terijoki, from the steeple of our church. It was a piteous situation. I knew where my duty lay. My duty was to was with ST-25, contact him in Petrograd or Moscow, wherever he might be, and then bring back my contact, Sokolov, and thus establish this chain of communication with London. That was my duty and my job. On the other hand, I knew where the Admiral was extremely perturbed about this bombardment of Krasnaya Gorka. His duty was the liberation of Estonia, and with Krasnaya Gorka, with offensive intention on the Russian part, Estonia was threatened on the whole of her frontier. Well, ST-31 offered to send a telegram to London and ask permission for me to attack these bombarding ships, which might stop them. The bombardment went on all day and the next before a reply came back. A reply that I had seen to my disappointment was, your boats should be used for intelligence purposes only, unless otherwise directed by the senior naval officer. In other words, unless otherwise directed by Admiral Cowan. Well, there's where I saw daylight. A decision had to be taken, and the Admiral was at sea. I couldn't communicate with him, but I knew from what he told me that he would, as he would support me in anything I did. I was absolutely certain of that. So I argued to myself that if I could get Sokolov back and thus establish our contact with ST-25, I could then take fortune in my hands and try and deliver an attack on these Russian battleships, which were quite close to Terijoki, not more than, I would say, a matter of 20 miles, if that. The bombardment continued. And then came the day for me to, as arranged, to bring Sokolov back. Everything went exactly as before. Tension terrific, of course. Hard for me to explain it. One can only imagine one's feelings, oneself. But at the same time, a certain amount of exhilaration. One felt, at least I felt, that I had a mission to perform, and I was doing it. When we got to the place in the River Neva, about the same time, 2 o'clock in the morning, looked around, nothing to be seen. So waiting in these cases like this is appalling. Waited 5 minutes, 10 minutes, each minute seems an hour, and then I heard a low, what you might call wail, and the sound of oars. Yes, it was him. Then the three flashes, our secret signal. Yes, and within a minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes perhaps, he was alongside, dead beat. The story would come later. The thing was to get him on board, and the pram, the little dinghy. We did both. Start up the engine again, and away, back through the chain of forts. We successfully accomplished this, back to Teriyaki. So my mission was finished, accomplished, between many other trips. That was the first, but I'd shown the way. Now I felt I was more free to give attention to these bombarding ships. Next day, there seemed a lull. We climbed to our church steeple. But there seemed to be a pall of smoke, heavy smoke, all over, lying all over Kronstadt. No bombarding ships appeared to be there. They'd gone, and obviously gone back to harbour. What had happened? Well, later on in the day, the armoured cruiser Oleg came out, and in the afternoon it started slow bombardment. It went steadily on till 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock in the evening. So there was no respite, and obviously the two battleships that had gone back to harbour were more ammunition. Well, I decided myself that yes, it was my target, and I'd go in and have a crack at it anyway. I left at slow speed, very slow speed, across the minefield, round about midnight, by which time it was pretty well dark. I didn't want to go too fast because of the bow wave. The bow wave would, the one thing that would give us away. So I kept a fairly slow speed until I reached the lighthouse, Tolbukin Lighthouse. And it was not far from this lighthouse where the cruiser was anchored. She was guarded by patrol craft and also a screen of destroyer. I first of all had to get through. I chose a gap between two destroyers and I went for that. Everything had to be done at, say, between 12 and 20 knots, so as not to produce a bow wave of any size at all. But unfortunately, it's just as I was going through the gap between the two destroyers, I had an accident in the boat. Now, this I must explain. My crew consisted of the Hampshire, the midshipman, Beely, faithful Beely, the mechanic, myself, no one else. We wore our uniforms, and I had my little white ensign, the white ensign that we flew in the boat. But the torpedo in our CMBs is fired astern, it's pushed astern by a ram. And then once it's in the water, an automatic device in the torpedo picks up the speed and revs the propellers at high speed. So the torpedo rapidly gathers speed and passes the boat. One must be careful then, that immediately after firing, to get out of its way. There's a definite risk of the torpedo hitting the boat if you don't. This must always be accepted. The firing of the torpedo, however, is done by means of a cartridge, a cordite cartridge, which is put in a chamber and fired. That cartridge pushes the ram pushes the torpedo, and that's where the business is done. Just after I'd given the order, get ready, to the midshipman, whose job it is to get the torpedo ready and put the cartridge in, something must have gone wrong, because he had fired the torpedo by mistake. The whole boat shuddered. It's the most dreadful thing. Luckily, again, my luck was in. I had the preventive stops down. Now, to prevent the torpedo from moving in the trough, these iron stops are fitted. And although the cartridge fired the ram had no, it couldn't overcome the stops. And the torpedo remained in the boat. It only remained, therefore, for a new cartridge to be put in. Not so easy when one's at high tension. And the choppy sea was running, not a big one, but quite choppy enough to make things most uncomfortable and unpleasant. It occurred just as we were in the middle of passing the destroyer, so there was nothing to do except stop the boat while we reloaded. And so I said as calmly as I could to Hampshire and Beely, I said, put in the spare cartridge and reload. It seemed to me that that reloading process must have taken 3 hours. I don't suppose it took 3 minutes, but they did it between the two. And I was so sorry for Hampshire, one could see he was so shaken. And I don't think he ever recovered from the shock. Anyway, we reloaded the cartridge and I went on to my target. We got the target in the, as far as I could judge, in my sights, and fired at her at a range which I calculated to be between 500 and 1,000 yards for ideal range for the purpose. And once she was fired, I had to get out of the way, turn the boat round, and crack on full speed and make my getaway. Unfortunately, I had been seen before firing a torpedo and had drawn the fire of everything on all sides. I was like a rabbit being chased by all and sundry. And There's hardly time to think or look, to concentrate on my boat and put on which now going at high speed was sufficient protection against the firing of the forts. And I could hear the shells whistling overhead, but it's not very pleasant when they splash, and one has to send the boat through the column of water the splash throws up. That's not pleasant. But we got away. I looked behind, and I saw that our torpedo had found the mark. A large column of smoke, almost as high as the mast of the ship, shot up, and a big red flash. There was no doubt about it. I'd hit the target. But whether she would sink or whether she would swim was another matter. My job was to get home. Well, we shaped a course not to Terioki, but out of the Gulf of Finland. I did so as to leave the impression with the forts and the guardships that we came from Bjorko and not from the mainland. Otherwise, I'd be giving the secret of our secret base away. And only when we were well clear, 20 miles at least, did I turn inland and fetch up again at our home in Terioki. The next day, as soon as it was daylight, we again went to our observation post at the top of the church steeple. We were there most of the day, watching what was going on. And I could see nothing. The battleships, the two Russian battleships, hadn't come out. They'd remained in Kronstadt, obviously. A pall of smoke was hanging over the whole island of Kronstadt, obviously showing. The Finnish commandant told me that one Russian ship had come out with a white flag in token of surrender. All sorts of rumors were flying around that Kronstadt had surrendered. In fact, one small boat, one of their patrol craft, did reach Bjorko and surrender to the admiral. Now, I must interrupt you. I must interrupt here for a little while and explain that also at Terioki, the Finns had a small detachment of frontier guards under a Finnish officer called Colonel Sarin, a very nice man. I had to make myself known to him, and this is where, again, the hand of Mr. Bell appeared. Mr. Bell approached General Mannerheim, who was the regent of Finland. They were great friends, and a word from the regent to the commandant to give me all the help he could was quite sufficient, and it arrived. So I had little difficulty with that source of trouble. I felt I must take the commandant into my confidence and tell him what I've done. That, I felt, was only fair. He was staggered. "Do you mean to tell me," he said, "that you, a civilian, in that fast boat of yours, has attacked and probably sunk a large Russian armored cruiser?" I said, "No, sir. We were wearing our uniform clothes on that occasion. I had permission to do so. And I know our admiral will support me, and I know that General Mannerheim will support the Admiral. He then got up and patted me on the shoulder, said something in Russian, which ST-30 said was extremely complimentary to me. He said, "My duty really is to stop you from doing anything more. We will get ourselves here a retaliation from the Bolsheviks. Do you realize the Kronstadt guns can reach this village?" I said, "Yes, I know that." "Did you realize also that their aeroplanes, they have a base, Ariane-born, can bombard the village and your boats?" I said, "Yes, I know." I said, "I'll, nevertheless," I said, "that's what I decided on my own responsibility I would do. I was not under orders. My own responsibility, Commandant. But give me some help with transport. I must see your Admiral." He was on telephone with his colleague at Fort Inonino, to which was attached a small Finnish airbase with three or four planes. I went there, got a Swedish officer, a very fine pilot called Reichel, Arthur Reichel, and he flew me over the Gulf. And I said, "I want to go as close as you can to Tolbukhin Lighthouse," which he did. And there I could see the Oleg at the bottom, quite clearly through the water, lying on her side. She was sunk. That was sufficient for me. Back at the aerodrome, I found my way to Koivisto, and from Koivisto I got a boat to the flagship, and I reported to the Admiral what I had done. Nobody could have been more pleased, more delighted. He wanted every word, every detail I told him. And he said, "I admire not only your courage," he said, "but the responsibility you took on yourself. You have helped me, because the Bolshevik fleet will know now that I have a sting, and I can use this sting if I want to. Whereas before, they knew I had only light cruisers to use against their capital ships. Now I have a bit more." The reaction at the Admiralty was not, I understand, at first, was not very good. And I am told it was not very popular, as there was a strong party in England, particularly the Labour Party, with a certain amount of justification on their side, using the slogan "Hands off Russia." The Admiralty were in a cleft stick. On the one side, politically, they had the "Hands off Russia," and on the other, they had the essential purpose of the British fleet, which was to secure the independence of the Baltic states. The immediate effect upon myself of what I'd done, I was proud and glad for our team that we'd achieved, first of all, success, and we'd got out of the way. We'd done something for the fleet. That's at least the Admiral told me we had. So much so that, to my surprise, I received a signal from him that I'd been awarded the Victoria Cross. That's what I got it for. And anyone who's been awarded a medal like that will know what it means.